Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Sherita Cole Brown, and we will be talking about her new book, Define the Verdict, My Bipolar Life. During her final semester of college, Sherita Brown suffered a psychotic episode, frighteningly reminiscent of her grandmother's own breakdown and subsequent hospitalization. Afterwards, she was diagnosed with an extreme form of bipolar disorder. Vowing to remain honest, Sherita details her struggle after her diagnosis, a life full of love, hope, and success. Sherita's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to her book there in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Sherita to the show. Good day, Sherita.
Good day, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And it looks like I have a little bit of a storm going on overhead here. So if you hear some thundering and that kind of thing, or if, God forbid, I have a little bit of a break in communication, we'll be right back on. But other than that, I'm really looking forward to speaking with you today.
Me too.
Great. So let's start with, first of all, what inspired you to write this particular book about your journey and share it with the world? Because it's quite a personal look into your life.
It really is. I initially thought about what's the one thing I need to put out into the world? I saw that comment, what's your one? And when I reflected on it, I thought my one is to write a memoir about how I am able to live successfully with bipolar.
Wow. So now, did you have any reservations at all about, about putting out there? Because, obviously, everyone in your life, is going to, know all of the intimate details. And so did you have any reservations at all?
Very scary. It came to me to write the book in 2009. The book was published in 2018. So, yes, there was some apprehension and approbation. Yes, there was. And even along the way, in 2013, someone had suggested to me that I make the book like an allegory, or that I fictionalize it, as other authors have done. But the reason I didn't was because I decided that people need to see that I am an actual person living well with a bipolar diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, and I've had many an author write their memoirs, and in both forms, very straightforward, raw, truthful, and allegory, and what I have found is that those who write the raw truth and kind of really put it out there, making themselves the most vulnerable, actually seem to get the best response from, sharing their story, because people see you, like you said, as a person, a real person, and then they can relate, probably to various aspects of your story. If they're not, coping with a bipolar, aspect, or someone in their life, because it goes beyond just affecting you, it affects everybody around you.
Very well stated, Robert. Very well stated.
Yeah. So the name of your book is Define the Verdict. So what is the verdict that you were defying or you are defying?
The verdict that I was defying that was that I would probably end up in custodial care given the severity and frequency of my episodes, because bipolar disorder is a brain-based illness, and the more ups and downs you have, the more it affects your brain. So it having that toll being taken on your brain, you can get to the point where you're not as functional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was cutting you off. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, I had a gentleman from Australia. His name is Kevin Scott, who was a former Olympian, who is, coping with bipolar parts of his life, but also had cancer aspects. And to him, he said the bipolar was the more difficult because of that uncertainty aspect.
Yes, I can agree with him. And for me, it was difficult, even more difficult, because I wasn't willing to accept the diagnosis. The title of the book is based on there's an author, a writer, whose name is Norman Cousins. And Norman Cousins said, don't defy the diagnosis, try to defy the verdict. And so I came to that for the title of my book. And, when I was trying to do a subtitle so it didn't look like a story about a trial, I decided I had read many, many people's memoirs. And I decided there were a couple people who had subtitled their books A Bipolar Life. But I made mine My Bipolar Life because I figured if I'm putting this out there, I'm just going to own it all the way.
There you go. That's the way to do it. So yeah, and it is so good that you have that subtitle, because obviously then people know exactly what they're getting, when it comes time to picking up the book and reading it. Now, at what point in your life did you become aware that what you were experiencing was called bipolar disorder?
Okay, it used to be called manic depression. I was and my grandmother was manic depressive, my maternal grandmother, as was my maternal great uncle. So the illness was in the family. I was diagnosed at the age of 21 with bipolar disorder. And I had my first significant bout of depression was at 16 as a senior in high school. But I was diagnosed, as I said, at 21.
Yeah.
So that was 5 years later.
Yeah. That's and I would think that wouldn't be uncommon, because everyone goes through periods of depression or so to get to the point of recognizing that manic aspect also, I would think that it would take time. Now, you spoke about your maternal grandmother. Now, I think one of the most touching parts in the book is your description of your grandmother's episode at the house and then subsequently in the hospital, and you going there, recognizing that. So that obviously made a big impression on you at the time, as a child.
I was afraid of psychiatric hospitals. I was afraid, I don't know if people really have like foreshadowing. But for me, sometimes, and you know, my daughter would call it just being dramatic, but I felt by the time I was like in eighth grade, I thought that I might have the illness. And it wasn't even that I had seen it. It was just that I thought, you know, or as I put it, when I spoke it to my older sister, I said to her, I said, you know, Val, I think I might be crazy. And her response, as in the book, is, everybody's crazy. And that took me through many years because I was like, oh, everybody's crazy. My sister told me that everybody's crazy. So I don't have to worry about if I'm having like a dip in mood because she's already told me that that's the case in life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, and there's a lot of truth to that, first of all. You know, that everybody got a little bit of crazy in them, you know. And but you know, to me, it's interesting that you had that intuitive knowing, just that, you know, that sense. And like, you know, you said your first, you know, bout of depression was at 16. So that would have been just after the crazy, right? After the crazy comment
well,
that your sister
had
made.
A little longer, because the crazy comment was in eighth grade. So that was probably at 12.
Okay, so yeah, that was quite a bit different. So when it came time to that you were diagnosed at 21, and recognizing that you know, that experience that you had with your grandmother, what was going through your head at that moment? I mean, was it that fear of possibly following in the same path that she had?
What I really felt was fear and shame. You know, I felt ashamed that I could not handle my own mood. So being really manic whenever that would happen was really like fun in the moment, because I would be completely uninhibited and do whatever I wanted to do and think I was the greatest person in the world. But when I would crash, then I would remember all the things I had done, and I would be really ashamed. And I would think, this is not me. This is not who I'm supposed to be. And, you know, the first time that I was hospitalized, I thought, you know, this is an anomaly. I'm going to work my way out of this. But that was in 1981. When I got out of the hospital, they wanted to give me medication, and I wouldn't take it because I'm like, this is an anomaly. I don't need anything. This isn't going to happen to me again, this mania thing. The depressions I could handle, but not the mania.
Huh. Now, see, that's different. I mean, you when you think about it, I would think, you know, just kind of logically, that the mania, that aspect of being up and free and energetic and uninhibited, you know, that would be kind of like the fun part of life, you know. And you know, and I think a lot of people, you know, would like to experience, you know, those quote, you know, high moments. But then, you know, the depression is can be a really difficult aspect. So I'm kind of surprised that, you know, the depression aspect was easier for you to handle than the mania side.
Well, one of my readers said the same thing. It was like one of my pre-readers. She was like, Mommy, you know, it was my daughter. She said, Mommy, you know, you are really different than a lot of other people. And it was because when I was a child, like 12 years old, my mother had gone through a period of depression, and she got better. And so my concept of depression was it was something that you could deal with. You know, if you were depressed, you would do what you needed to do. If you needed to take medication, you would take the medication. But you would eventually be all right, because that's what I had seen with my mom. But the manic part was not something that I was seeing as controllable. And it was also the humiliation component because I was a very controlled person.
Oh, okay. So with that part of your nature, that, you know, very controlled part of your nature, you know, and you said when you went through those mania aspects that, you know, after coming down out of that, that you felt shame. Now, how did you reconcile that aspect? I mean, because in one sense it seems that, you know, you have that part of your nature is, you know, what was expressed during that manic, you know, state, you know, but then also part of your nature is being controlled. So, I mean, those are kind of two contrary, you know, aspects, facets of who you are. So at this particular point in life, are you still very controlling
living in control of myself.
Yeah.
I'm a little controlling too, but you have to ask certain people. Living in control of myself. But what I'm saying with that, one of the things that I talk about in the book is I did a lot of theater when I was younger, and it really nourished my soul and my spirit. And I did improvisational theater. And in improv, people think that it's just real loosey-goosey, but it's not. It's very tight, and it is controlled. You have to work with the people that you're going to work with. You have to know what these people's strengths and weaknesses are. I mean, you do exercises and activities and trust things so that when you're in the moment of the improv, you are with people who understand what's going on. So for me, when I was going through mania, it was like an out of control improvisation. Like, what's she going to do next? What's she going to do next? Next, next, next. And I wasn't controlling the next. And I wasn't able, like in an improv, you can stop it. Like you can, if it's getting to be like too much, or you can see that one of the people in the improv is not, you know, handling it well, or it's going in a direction you don't want it to go, you can bring it back, you can stop it, you can control it. But with mania, I wasn't controlling it. It was more that it was happening. It was out of control.
Okay, that makes sense. So now you mentioned, you know, after the first hospitalization that they wanted to put you on medication and you weren't going to have any part of that. You thought that you could, you know, that, like you said, it was an anomaly. What type of treatment have you done, or, you know, and kind of what aspects of treatment worked for you and what aspects maybe wasn't helpful?
Okay. In 1982, that was when I left Wesleyan in the throes of a psychotic break. And that's where the book begins, me in the throes of the psychotic break. So when I left Wesleyan and I was hospitalized, or I refer to it as being committed, because two doctors put me in the hospital both times. I didn't have a say as whether or not I would go. So it was like, okay, she's a danger to herself and others, and she has to be hospitalized. And they told me, you are not leaving, basically, you know, in layman's terms, you are not leaving here unless you agree to be medicated. Because when I came, I completely lacked insight, which is what happens when you're manic. I completely lacked insight, and they needed to bring me down from that state. So they gave me a medication immediately, but then I had to agree to take something on an ongoing basis. So I did. I took lithium, and I took that, which is and naturally occurring salt on the periodic table. And then they gave me another medication, and that medication was something that they used to give to people who were schizophrenic. And the reason I was given that medication was to just cover their bases. And then, you know, in the book I talk about the back years ago and probably still some today, people of color are sometimes misdiagnosed with schizophrenia because there were doctors who didn't think people of color were smart enough or creative enough to be bipolar.
I know, that just drives me crazy.
I have a friend who's a psychiatrist, and she said that she was so sorry that that happened. And, you know, now she's at the Hopkins Mood Disorders Clinic. Her name is Karen Swartz, and she does the Adolescent Depression Awareness Program. And she said now when they train young psychiatrists, they are training them to be more open-minded and to recognize that bias.
Yeah. So now, as far as those two medications, is that something that you still take, or just take the lithium?
They only gave me the second medication for a year, because I ended up back in the hospital in 1983, and that was when I took myself. We were at 82 in March to April. In 1983, as many people do who are bipolar, I decided I was better and took myself off my medication. And I ended up hospitalized again because I really needed it. But I decided that I didn't. I decided that I was doing fine and I didn't need medication at that point. And it is, you know, it is not for you as a patient or as a client who are not a clinician. You are not a clinician, I tell people. It is not for you to decide that you don't need medication anymore. And it oftentimes ends poorly, as it did for me. And I ended up back in the hospital.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing. And like I said, I've had a couple of people on the shows over the last 7 years that have dealt or are dealing with, you know, that aspect. And, it seems that that's a very common
It's a very common
belief. Yeah.
And that's one of the things proactively I try to tell people. Just because you feel a little better does not mean, you know, let your doctor decide that. Don't go off your medication because you are balanced. Because most times if you are balanced, it's a result of doing everything that you need to do.
Right. Yeah, the one thing is, too, is that I think people are resistant to the idea that they have to do something for the rest of their life, in many cases, because then, you get that feeling like, what is wrong with me, in a sense, that even I go through this period, that I still need this. And I think that kind of comes up a lot, when people are, especially if they've been on a program for a long period of time.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So basically now you are taking, was it lithium right now? I mean, is that
I no longer take lithium.
Okay.
Lithium had an effect on my kidneys, and so I had to stop taking it, and I take a different medication now.
Okay.
Which is working for me.
Good.
So I haven't taken lithium, I would say, probably for the past 5 years. But
okay.
I'm taking something that
right.
does work. But when you were talking about why people don't want to, you know, don't want to take psychotropic medications, a lot of it has to do with stigma, you know, with mental health stigma. You know, people associate, you know, disgrace and shame and a dark mark with mental illness. And so people are afraid of mental illness. People are really scared because it's something that they don't understand. And a lot of times things that we don't understand scare us. And so we don't create a culture where people can get the help that they need. And it's negative in our society. You know, people don't get the help. They just don't get the help they need because of the stigma, because I don't want people to think that I'm not strong on my own. And also because people around you, when they don't understand either. So I go back to Mental Health Month was in May, and this is Minority Mental Health Month, which is July. And NAMI has done a hashtag Cure Stigma thing. I'm a member of NAMI, and I do some programs with NAMI. And what NAMI talks about is that treat stigma as a virus, and it's 100% curable. So if you can cure the virus and cure the fear around mental illness, more people will get help because they're not afraid of what others will think or what they will think about who they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, for listeners who don't know, NAMI is... What organization?
NAMI is it's the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and it is the largest grassroots mental illness organization in the United States.
Great. And I just wanted to get that out there so that the listeners would be able to, you know, quickly, I'm sure they can probably just Google it and find it, but I just wanted to make sure that they knew.
Yes,
exactly
and
what
a wonderful,
was.
There is, NAMI exists, I would think, in every state. I am affiliated with NAMI Maryland because I live in Maryland,
mm-hmm.
and NAMI Metro Baltimore, which is Baltimore City, Baltimore County, because I live in Baltimore. But if people can look at their state and find a NAMI, an AMI, because
mm-hmm.
it's very helpful. It has, you know, now I'm pitching it because I'm very active, but there are many programs for people to gain awareness through NAMI.
Yeah, you know, and you're right so much. There is such a need for education, you know, because when you talked about, you know, people just not understanding what mental illness is. I mean, if someone did not have someone in their family who was dealing with an issue like that, and you only looked at media, you know, you would only see the crazy, you know, the world gone amok.
That's what
you would see.
And
you don't see all the, you know, other people that are, you know, working day in and day out and leading, you know, very productive
lives
with. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for people who are not leading productive lives, it's important, you know, for people like myself, Dr. Kay Jamison, who wrote An Unquiet Mind and incidentally blurred my book, and I was really excited. She has a group of people that she calls the silently successful. And I used to be one of those until I wrote the book. Because there are people who are living well with mental illness, who are living well with being bipolar. But people don't know because we don't talk about it. We don't want to be grouped with the crazies that people are talking about swinging from the chandelier and all that. And sometimes we did swing from the chandelier. But we don't want to be grouped. But you had asked,
right.
you know, why write the book? And I needed to write the book because I needed to say, look, I defied the verdict of ending up on custodial care. If you do what you need to do for yourself, you can be okay. You know, you can be okay. I had said the anomaly of being in a, you know, the one mm-hmm. one instance of illness, but getting well is not an anomaly either.
Yeah, yeah, very much. And you need to recognize, you know, for an individual who goes, you know, through that kind of experience, it's important to recognize and, you know, have diagnosed and treatment, you know.
Yes.
In
yes.
the event that it is not an anomaly.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if we can talk about it more, I'm a retired teacher, and I believe mm-hmm. that, as you were alluding to, that we learn through education. And if people are aware of what mental illness is, and that mental illnesses are highly treatable, they won't be mm-hmm. as afraid. And they'll be on the lookout if you have a friend who is suffering, so mm-hmm. you can help get them to the correct place. You know, I'm incidentally about to be trained in how to do the NAMI help, my local NAMI helpline. I already took a mental health first aid class. It's important to be able to see when somebody's in trouble and not have it freak you out and help them. You know, not that you're a clinician, but knowing some things to do, like knowing not to upset them further, or, you know, helping to calm them down, helping them to get to the right place. And sometimes it's just helping a person feel like they're not alone and they're not a burden to themselves or to society, and that they don't have to take their own life.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know,
very
suicide
much, and
prevention is a big part of understanding, you know, mental illness.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, when you talked about awareness and education, I mean, you know, years and years ago, when it came time to discussing cancer, it was always the C word. You know, people didn't talk
yes.
about it, you know.
That's right.
You know, but now it's very open. People have there have been many examples of people who have kind of beaten it, or at least, you know, staved it off. And, you know, there are just many ways of. So, I mean, it's one of those areas that, you know, it's talked about more freely, you know, and
mm-hmm.
doesn't have the stigma. But mental health is still one of those last frontiers that really needs to
yeah.
Be destigmatized. So,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And people
so now,
get
yeah. mm-hmm.
become afraid of mental illness.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, with gun violence, you have to understand, people who are listening, more people with a mental illness are more likely to be a victim than to be the person who is victimizing. And sometimes when we have instances of people who are committing gun violence, they are just angry people. They are not always mentally ill, but it's thrown out. Oh, they must be mentally ill, but they're not always.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at stats, people with, you know, with mental illness are more often victims of crimes. But there was something that you were saying when we were talking about the suicide and the stigma. Recently, we've had two people with bipolar illness who have committed suicide, and that would be Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade. And
mm-hmm.
both of them had diagnoses. And I know for Anthony Bourdain, I was seeing and reading that, you know, people didn't know. They thought that he was fine. So what it brings up is just the importance of understanding mental illness and checking on one another, you know, checking
on our fellow human beings. And I'm not saying that we can prevent, we can necessarily prevent every suicide, but we have to check on each other. We have to love each other. We have to have people who, you know, I have a sister who just listens to my voice, and I laugh because there is an app that they have created at the National Network for Depression Centers that is being able to pick up, you attach it to your phone, and your designated person will be able to know if there's a change in your tone of voice and to know if you're getting depressed or if you're getting elated. My sister does that. My sister Valerie, the same one that told me everybody's crazy, she does that for me. She can hear if my, you know, if my voice is getting a little too rapid or if it's getting a lot too slow. She could hear that. So I guess she's an app. But you have
just,
to.
If Valerie, Valerie's listening, Sarita's doing just great.
You know,
you're so right. You know, in those particular cases, I mean, you know, in the Kate Spade aspect, you know, her husband kind of knew what was going on, you know, and that she was going through. But your point about connecting, having people check in. Or the whole idea is to be, you know, because people who are, you know, either depressed or get to the point of thinking of suicide, there is a distinct feeling of disconnection from the world, you know, and connection is the way back.
That's right. And those of us who see it, I was talking to someone recently about that because he had a friend who he could feel disconnecting. And, you know, he called me and what he, you know, I said, I'm not a clinician, but you can, I said, you're doing the right thing because you're connecting with him. That's what you need to do because people don't need to feel like they are alone.
Right.
And it happens sometimes. And I'm not being pie in the sky and saying, you know, if we understand that if we get balance, nobody will commit suicide ever again. But I do think if we can reduce some of the stigma around mental illness and increase the conversation, we can have fewer people that take their own lives because they have somebody letting them know, I am here for you. I am holding your hand. I am not. I'm not walking away from you. I see what's going on with you. And a lot of times, it's like you just said so beautifully. It's disconnect. It's disconnection that people feel like out there by themselves. And it's important for people to understand that. A lot of times when people take their own lives, there are a lot of people that really did care about them, but they didn't know because nobody, you know, nobody said it. I think it was Anthony Bourdain's best friend who had spoken to him, and he said he had no idea. He had no idea because his friend did not give him a clue. And so, you know, so I'm not saying that everybody's going to know, but I am saying that I think sometimes we just need to be kinder and more compassionate to one another because I feel like everybody's going through something. Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how much money you have. I don't care what race or gender you are. I feel like everybody is going through something. And if we can show kindness to one another and have some compassion, it'll make it better for people, especially in the mental illness arena.
Yeah, exactly. And in the, you don't have to know the answers or know the problem or know the details. A lot of times it's just a matter of being there and listening, you know, and just acknowledging the other person's value, you know, just value to, you know, to the world, you know, and so it's real important. Now, I was surprised when you mentioned about, you know, that additional medication, because they thought that black people weren't smart enough to, you know, have that manic. I mean, that just blew me away. So kind of along that line, is there any, do you feel that there are any particular challenges to working, to either identifying or working with, or someone who's experiencing, you know, a bipolar issue, for a black person and for a woman? I mean, you kind of fall into both of those categories, and I'm wondering if you feel there are any particular challenges.
I think, you know, there are checklists of that people look at, because there's not like a blood test that you can take to find out if somebody is bipolar. What you are, and some people are misdiagnosed, but what you are looking at is behaviors. And what they use is called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And I guess now they're on the DSM-5. And there is a listing of behaviors that people show forth. And if you're showing forth a certain number of behaviors, that's how they decide if you are bipolar. So there's bipolar 1, which I'm diagnosed with, and then there's bipolar 2, which is a different illness. And that's mostly depression, but if you ever have a hypomanic or uptick behavior, then you are diagnosed as bipolar 2.
Okay.
But it is important, you know, as you were saying, to understand, you know, currently about 2.6% of the United States population is diagnosed with bipolar disorder. That's about 5.7 million people. And
that's
people
folks
who have been diagnosed. There are definitely more who have not been diagnosed. So when you think about, and we're just talking about people 18 years old and over. So bipolar disorder is, you know, is present in our society. So we have to accept it and do things to make it better for people who have that particular illness.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the individuals in your family who have dealt with it. Is it considered, I mean, since it's diagnosed behaviorally, is it, how does genetics play into it? Or is it maybe the learned behaviors, you know, that maybe is what passes it on generationally?
Okay, for me, it is definitely a genetic illness. In my book, and I'll try to encapsulate it. My family tree goes this way. Our family, the Stanleys, were in Dorchester County at the same time as Harriet Tubman was a slave. They were a group of free blacks who got their name from a white woman, Mary Stanley, who started a family with a black man, and they had all of these children, and the children intermarried. It's similar to like Tay-Sachs disease, but what incubated in our family were genes for bipolar disorder and clinical depression. So there are people in the families of my mom's maternal family that do have bipolar. Not a lot of us have bipolar, but there are people with clinical depression. But there are mm-hmm. other people who have bipolar other than myself. They're not all talking about it, but hopefully mm-hmm. there will mm-hmm. be more talking about it now that I have written a book about it. Because
right.
it's important for it not to be
uh-huh.
a secret.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So now I want to kind of get you in the advice-giving mode for a second here. So if we have people listening who are currently experiencing bipolar illness, what would your advice be to them? What would you say directly to those who are experiencing this?
What I would say is find yourself a good clinician. Go to a doctor, because it's something that has to be diagnosed. So once you have a diagnosis, which is a good diagnosis, then do what you need to do. If you need therapy, go to therapy. If you need medication, take medication. If you are medication resistant, work with somebody to figure out what works for you so you can be healthy. People do yoga. I exercise. I make sure I eat well, because
mm-hmm.
bipolar disorder is a brain illness. So that makes it a body
mm-hmm.
illness. So I take care of my body. And that's one thing we have to do. If we have bipolar disease, or if you have high blood pressure, you have to take care of your body. So, for me, with the genetic link, I have to take care of myself. I am not well because the diagnosis wasn't true. I am well because there were a lot of other things that I did. I take medication. I did 2+ years of intensive therapy, which for me was with a pastoral counselor.
Mm-hmm.
I pray a lot. Some people don't believe in prayer. I do. I pray a lot. I know people that do yoga and meditate, and I meditate as
mm-hmm.
well. You have to figure out what works so that your life can be balanced. Because the truth of the matter is, Robert, that this is an illness that will allow you to lead a good life if
mm-hmm.
you do the things that you need to do.
Yeah, very important. Now, with that advice to those who are experiencing it, what advice would you give to people who have family or loved ones who are experiencing this? Again, this is something that affects not only the person, but like virtually any kind of disease or disorder. I mean, that also
right.
affects the people around you. So what advice would you give to those loved ones who want to help?
Well, there really is no cookie-cutter response, but you can.
Okay.
What you want is for your family member to get help. If they
mm-hmm.
will not get help, you can get help for yourself so that you have an understanding. For instance, and I go back to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, there are classes that you can take to learn more about mental illness. There is a NAMI Basics class. There's a NAMI Family class, a family-to-family class, where it's a 10 or 12-week course where you come and you learn from people who have experienced being the family member of somebody with
Perfect.
A mental illness. So when you're doing the NAMI things, you are dealing with people, not people who are clinicians, you are dealing with
right.
people who have experienced mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
So when I do what are called In Our Own Voice presentations, where I talk about mental illness, my mental illness, I'm talking about my mental illness. And so people can make that connection, because we're trying to take, we're trying, as you, your word, to destigmatize, so people are not afraid to get the help that they need.
Well, that's perfect. That was exactly what I was hoping to put out there for for people who want to be helpful. Because, you know, that's, you know, it, like we're all in this together, you know, and anything that we can do, you know, to make, you know, our loved ones' lives better, you know, there are certain
that's right.
things that we can do. And yeah, and that's a great thing. So now, my last question for you is, what do you hope that people are going to take away from reading Defying the Verdict?
When somebody reads Defying the Verdict, My Bipolar Life, the one thing that I want, it's probably two parts, but one of the things I want them to understand is that Sherita Cole Brown is not waiting for the other shoe to drop. I have been in recovery for more than 25 years. I have daughters who are 27 and 28 years old. My 28-year-old, when people ask her what it's been like to have a bipolar mom, she says, well, I really can't tell you. I did have postpartum when I had her, but not my younger daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still affected. You know, I had the postpartum depression
mm-hmm.
when I had my older daughter. But the things that I have been doing have been sustaining me, and I am not the only person in the world. Like, if you talk to Dr. Kay Jamison, she's doing extremely well. There are other people in the world who are doing very well, but what we have to do is come out and talk to people, because it's important. You know, some people's books that I read, that I've read, or people I've talked to, they're waiting for the other shoe to drop. It's like, I don't know if I can
mm-hmm.
make it. And that's a legitimate feeling. But after so many years of really having a system of, and what I didn't say, of staying away from stress, you know, if things are too stressful, I have to walk away. My house
yeah.
is a place of peace. I go sit in my house, and I don't have all kinds of erratic things happening, because that's my house, and I have to have peace. So I've learned over the course of time what I have to do so that I can be well. And, you know,
right.
what I hope when people read the book is that's part one. And then part two is that a person with a mental illness does not have two heads. They're a human being like
mm-hmm.
everybody else, and they deserve kindness and compassion like everybody else. And when you read my book, I had and have a fabulous family, and I have friends who supported me. So if somebody is struggling, don't drop them by the wayside, because I've found that almost nobody gets well by themselves. Even if they have one person, that one person is enough support to get through it. But we don't want people, you know, you read my book and you say, oh my goodness, she had her parents, she had her siblings, she had some friends, and every bipolar person doesn't have that. So, you know, point number one is, you know, you can be okay. It's an illness where you can live well, where you can be successful. And then point number two is, get yourself a friend, a buddy,
mm-hmm.
Somebody who can be a part of your life. And for some people, it is not a friend. It is a trusted therapist who they can talk to and who can help them through the difficulties that they are going through. So you just have to know what works for you. And that's how you defy the verdict. That's, for me, it's my bipolar life. For some people, it might be another mental illness. For some people, it
mm-hmm.
might be something else. But you have to first own it. You have to say, this is really
mm-hmm.
what it is. and then do everything in your power to overcome it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sherita, this has really been a wonderful conversation. You had so much good information for the listeners, and I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you and reading your book. So I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate. I had a great conversation with you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Now, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you, is there any particular way that they could do that?
Yes. DefyingTheVerdict@gmail.com, and then my number on my business cards is 410-585-5721. And we're setting things up where I'll be able to speak soon to people, to churches,
well,
to minorities,
yeah,
et cetera.
Groups. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Well, again,
yes.
Thank you so much for your time. And I'll be sure to add that email address and number into the show page description so that people can contact you for future speaking engagements.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again, and I look forward to being able to recommend your book to many people who are dealing with the bipolar life.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you again, everyone. Today, my very special guest has been Sherita Cole Brown, and we've been talking about her new book, "Define the Verdict: My Bipolar Life." As Define the Verdict, My Bipolar Life, and it is available from Amazon.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her book there in the show page description. And as she mentioned, if you wanted to contact her, you can email her at DefyingTheVerdict@gmail.com. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again... Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.